Now broadcasting from the Next Gen Conservative Studio in sunny South Florida, bringing you the latest in politics, current events, and pop culture. This is the Whitfield Report with Sam Whitfield.
Alrighty, folks, and welcome to the Whitfield Report Monday edition. Although we are recording this on a Thursday afternoon, by the time you guys are either watching this and or listening, it will be Monday. Nevertheless, happy to have you here. My guest for this week's Monday podcast is Terrence McCauley, who is a... I don't want to just say thrill author, because Terrence has written in all sorts of genres, some of which I wasn't even aware of, you know, what he was writing until I went onto his website just about 15 minutes ago and looked at some of his books. Although I did, I read Chicago 63, which is what we're primarily going to be talking about today, but I did just buy the University box set, like
they're for 99 cents now. Yeah,
so I bought the whole box set. I think it was like $2, and I only read the first chapter of the first book last night, so I didn't get too far into it, but I finished Chicago 63 and I loved it. And you know, Terrence is a great author, just from the bit I've read. So I'm happy to have him here. And Terrence, welcome to the show. Hope you're doing well.
I am, and thank you for having me here. It's great to be with you tonight.
So, thank you. Well, you know, I guess my first question is, how did you start writing and publishing? Like, where did the spark begin for you? You've had a pretty illustrious career, so how did it all get started?
Yeah, it's like a roller coaster, and it still is like a roller coaster, and I'm pretty happy about that. And I was blessed to get started on storytelling and writing at an early age. As I've said in other places, I grew up with a bunch of unique storytellers in my family. I had two uncles that were Catholic priests and pastors in New York City. So the amount of odd people and interesting stories that they came across in their daily lives was always interesting to hear around the dinner table. One of my uncles was also the chaplain at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, which is where a lot of the high profile female criminals would go after they were convicted of murder or attempted murder. So that was also interesting. And then I have an aunt who was a nun, who was a principal of an inner city high school in the Bronx. So there was always a lot of stories, a lot of characters floating around. No names, of course, because a lot of this was confidential. But it was interesting from an early age to see how people really were, who were much older than me, and to get a glimpse of what life was like. So I always had a knack and an ear for good storytelling. And I cultivated it off and on throughout grammar school and high school. Took a creative writing course when I was in college, and I was shocked by how many people liked it. So when I graduated college, I took some of those Gotham Writers Workshop classes that they had throughout the city and developed my talent that way, by workshopping ideas that I had and getting 30 or 40 different viewpoints of what I had written really made me a great writer of in the fact that I understood the craft and that I understood that not every good idea is a great one and not every idea needs to be expressed. So I worked on a couple of manuscripts on my own. Didn't really have any luck finding an agent because, quite frankly, the work probably wasn't strong enough at that point. But then a friend of mine drank coffee one day, and on the sleeve that she got from the deli, there was one of those cardboard sleeves that said, search for the next great crime writer contest for Court TV. It was Court TV at the time. Then it became True TV. So I submitted the manuscript I had that I called Prohibition, and it beat out 200 other books to win.
Wow.
The Search for the Next Great Crime Writer contest. And I was over the moon. I thought, this is great. It's going to be published by Borders, which was only a bookstore at the time, but they were thinking about getting into publishing.
Yeah.
HBO and Time Warner owned True TV at the time, because by then it was True TV. And they were interested in possibly developing it. I was so happy. Then what happened? Borders closed. The deal was forgotten about, and I didn't get anything published based on Prohibition at that time. And so it was pretty low when that happened.
Yeah.
And that's important for beginning writers to understand that just because something looks like it's going to break your way, it doesn't really count until you've got all the money in the bank, everything signed, and the check's clear. So
right.
People can promise you a lot, and they can say a lot's going to happen, but until it actually does happen, be guardedly optimistic. But I didn't let it stop me from doing what I loved, which was writing stories and making sure I got better in my craft. And I continued to write. I had a bunch of books all lined up when I met a publisher who said, I've read a lot of your 1930s stuff, but do you have a modern day thriller in you? And I had an idea in my head that I'd been playing around with the whole time that I had been writing other stuff. So I said, yeah, let me give it a shot. I wrote it in about 6 weeks, and that's what Sympathy for the Devil became. And the words just flew out of me once I set my mind onto that track. And I got it done very quickly. After a couple of rewrites, it hit the market, and I have been published ever since, and I'm blessed to be able to say that.
Yeah, your work is pretty prolific, and also, I'm assuming you're a native New Yorker, so, you know, living in New York, like, I'm not a native, but I've been to New York, like, 8 times within my life, and I imagine, mm-hmm. You know, that city is, in particular, is just a great place for storytelling. Just in
it
general,
is.
Because you never know what's going to happen at any given moment.
Right. Yeah, it is definitely a dynamic place. There's literally millions of different people going through there, especially the island of Manhattan every single day. And I always had a huge love of history, and I had a love of classic films. So when I wrote Prohibition and then Slow Burn, it was because I also loved politics. So I was able to merge all of my three loves together and create something that was actually based in history. And that was fantastic. And then I was able to use some of my knowledge of how government works when I started my techno thrillers in the university series.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's been constantly an evolution.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm kind of, I'm in the political thriller genre too. That's kind of the genre I've written in. And, I've heard your name thrown up. I hadn't really read you until, honestly, Chicago 63. I interviewed Steve Stratton, who I know you know, and I'm also
Steve's great.
Good friends with Eric Bishop. Eric was like, have you had Terrence on your podcast yet? And I was like, no. Do you think he would want to come on? And, so I...
Yeah, of course. Eric's a great guy.
Yeah. No, he is. So, just thrilled to be able to talk to all these different authors. So...
We're a pretty approachable bunch. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
You think people who write this kind of stuff wouldn't be, but everybody who has started out in this business remembers what it was like to start out in it. No matter whether you've achieved great fame like Jack Carr, who's really awesome to talk to and deal with. I interviewed him. He's a great guy. All the way down to people who've just started out and are still querying for their first book to hit with an agent or a publisher. We all started from the same place. Very few haven't, but most of us have. So we understand it. And we spend so much of our time creating in by ourselves. It's nice to be able to share some of our journey with us, especially when someone with somebody else, especially when people are interested in it.
Yeah, yeah. The funny thing about Jack Carr too is I wrote a short story back in 2014. I self-published my gap year between high school and college. And then mm-hmm. I was going to write a sequel, but once I got into college, I just didn't have the time. And then The Terminalist actually was released, I think, my sophomore year of college, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember the timeline now. But anyway, I read that when I was in college. And that book... I had grown up reading Tom Clancy's book, but The Terminalist was the book that kind of re-sparked my interest in writing. So
right.
I promised once I got done with, college, I would go back and look at some of my old outlines and notes and write something. And so I did just that in, at the end of 2023. Well, in July. Mm-hmm. But, Jack's a great storyteller, and I mean, I think he still has his career is, going to be quite prolific for the foreseeable future, I think.
I think so too. Yeah. And he's always looking for a way to give back to the writing community in general, but also people who are looking to write thrillers of any kind. And he's really generous, and quite frankly, he doesn't have to be, and it's really great to see that he is.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten that impression from him. But, enough about Jack. We're here to talk about your, work. So I am curious, you've written crime fiction. I see that you've even written a few Westerns, which is interesting. But yes. I'm curious, what made you... What inspired you to write this historical fiction crime novella with Chicago 63? Because I think it's very fitting for your style now that I've read some of your work, but it's also kind of a departure from some of your previous work. So, what inspired you to do Chicago 63, I guess?
Sure. Well, like I said earlier, my first published book was Prohibition. So that was set in 1930s New York. So I always had that love of history, politics, and crime thrillers. So even though I have written in a bunch of different genres, I've done the crime fiction, I've done Westerns, and I've done thrillers, I always loved good historical fiction because you can introduce the audience to a different type of vision that they might think of a certain time. Like when I wrote in the 1930s, everybody thought it was just a bunch of guys walking around with hats and gats, talking like Jimmy Cagney and shooting people. That wasn't really the case. It was a lot more, people were a lot more sophisticated than we give them credit for, because it was right after World War I. It was before World War II, and the Roaring Twenties were coming to an end when I set my book. So that kind of conjunction of eras really makes for a compelling storytelling. And that's what I loved to do when I was writing my 30s stuff. Then when I had this idea for Chicago 63, it was because it sprang out of a greater idea that I had for a trilogy based on the events that happened in Dallas 63, which is the trilogy I'm planning on writing, but told from a Dallas cop's perspective, a Dallas detective's perspective. Not getting into all of the international intrigue. James Ellroy, for example, did an incredible job with that, with his American Underworld series. Yeah. I'm not looking to do that. He did a masterful job, and he talked about Cuba. He talked about, some of his people traveled all over the region to set stuff up. I didn't want to do that. I want to tell it just from one perspective, because if you make a story like this too involved, too many characters, people lose interest, they get distracted, they just don't really want to spend that much time reading what might seem like a textbook on something they feel they already know something about. So I wanted to take a different perspective of it, to tell of it more as a crime rather than international intrigue or the stereotypical bunch of old guys in a smoky room puffing on cigars, chortling, and deciding how they're going to divvy up the world. That's great, and a lot of other writers have done it. It's not the kind of book I wanted to tell. And you've read a little bit of my style. You could see that I'm a lot more base than that. I don't like to get too far away from reality. So while I was trying to finish up the first draft of Dallas 63, I was talking to my friend James Apt over at Bestseller Books. Steve Stratton knows him quite well, so does Eric. And he said, well, do you have a novella in you about this era? Maybe you could, instead of trying to sell all three books, maybe you could put together something like a novella and see where that leads. So I thought about it, and I had done a ton of research into the Kennedy assassination and a lot of the various plots that people have discussed over the years. And usually I'm able to cut through a lot of that stuff, you know, like UFOs, Bigfoot. I love researching stuff, but when I research, I usually come out on the side of something in the real world explaining why a lot of this stuff happened. Not all of it, but, you know, a lot of times with the UFOs, it was just military technology that we didn't know they had. With Bigfoot, I think there's some gamesmanship there, and there's also some mistaken identity. There's a lot. I can always, ancient aliens was another theory that I've pretty much said people probably got around a lot more than we thought. I you know, that these weren't people. I don't think you necessarily need to solve every ancient mystery with, it was people coming down from outer space with tractor beams moving blocks. I just don't, I don't buy that.
Well, and listen, like, I think, you know, from my perspective, you know, like, I host a political podcast, or it's partially, you know, political some of the time. Mm-hmm. I get people who send me, you know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the whole QAnon conspiracy or what it is, but it's, you know, it's the idea that, like, we have a big shadow government. And, you know, I don't necessarily buy into all the QAnon stuff. However, I will say this, that, like, whenever someone sends me QAnon stuff, I'm like, I read it and I'm like, how can I make this into a political thriller?
Right.
Basically. And because even if I don't think it's true, I'm kind of like, well, if this were true, how would it, you know, how could I turn this into a gripping thriller? So
sure. And that's, and you see, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about when I was doing the research for Chicago, for Dallas 63. You get ideas by reading this stuff, even if you don't necessarily buy all of it. You know, like for me, I was in government for 25 years. Trust me, there is no such thing as the hyper prepared government agency out there. It just doesn't exist. And anybody who's ever served in the military, I haven't. I worked for state government, but I could tell you it's the same at the federal and the local and the state level too. There's not a room full of people just thinking stuff up in case something happens. It's still a very reactionary form of public management. Of course, there are people who have military contingencies for a variety of things. But in terms of every single thing being coordinated, that's just not possible. And that's what I find people fall down that rabbit hole when they look into the JFK stuff. They'll latch on to one theory, and that's what they stick with. And it, God forbid you try to cross them or you disagree with them just a little bit, they come right at you. And I'm sure you've probably had that experience with some of the QAnon people that you've talked to. They get their pet theories, and God forbid you don't agree with it one right down the line.
Or even not even if you necessarily agree with it, but even if you question the how of something or the why, they get really agitated even by that. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, now I will say this, with the Kennedy, assassination, assassination. It is a little weird to me, at least, that all of the documents after 60 years have still not been declassified. Like, the JFK is kind of the one thing where I am, where I do sit back and I do look and I think, well, maybe there were some rogue CIA guys, like an American tabloid or, you know, something, something like that. Maybe, there were some people that were out to get, you know, Kennedy within the government.
Sure. And asking those questions is what leads to really compelling thrillers or crime fiction in general. And that's what I did. I went into it thinking, you know, there's a lot of stuff here that just doesn't make sense. Like, there's some theories that all of the people who were part of Watergate, the break-in, the plumbers, they were all in Dealey Plaza. That is not true. That did not happen. I mean, it would be cool if it was, because it would tie everything up, but that wasn't the case. But there were a lot of loose ends as I was digging down further when you look at the tertiary characters, because you can argue about the path of the bullets, how many shooters were in Dealey Plaza all day long, and still not arrive at a cohesive conclusion.
Yeah.
But when you look at the people who were around Oswald and they're around these the Kennedy administration, you do get to see glimmers of light where you say, oh, this doesn't add up. There were a lot of intelligence people who were involved in Oswald's life, and more than people used to think, especially back when the Warren Commission came out. So that is fodder for a book like mine to come out.
So Abe Golden, your main character in Chicago 63, is based off a real-life Secret Service agent that I actually I knew that perspective on things, actually, because like you, I love history, and especially of that particular era in the 50s and 60s. How much of Abe's character is fiction, and then how much did you base off of James, I can't remember the guy's last name, but the actual Agent Golden.
Oh, Agent, yeah. The real agent is Abraham Bolden. I changed his name to Golden because this is a fictionalized account of what happened back then, but based in fact. Now, when I was doing Dallas 63, I had a really great character that I was going to base on Abraham Bolden, but he was only going to be in the book for the first third of it, and then he would disappear because the Chicago plot happens, and then there's really not much for him to do. So as I was writing the draft, I said, you know what? I've really gotten to like this character. I'm not really ready to do that to him, which is funny because it's all in my mind, but I'm saying this guy is too good for me just to write off and ignore, but I can't, in good conscience, keep him around just because I like him, because it won't serve the story any. So when James recommended that I try a novella, that's where I said, whoa, this would be an awesome vehicle for me to put Abraham Golden in. Now, so I pulled all of those parts out and I created what became Chicago 63. Abraham Bolden was in the Chicago office back in November of 1963 and months before then. He was also the first African-American Secret Service agent who ever protected a president. And he did that on Kennedy's request. Kennedy requested him and personally called him the Jackie Robinson of the Secret Service, which is an honor that the former agent still carries with him to this day. But in the book, I take a lot of what happened with a couple of different Secret Service investigations, and there were only about two or three other agents working on this in the president's approach to Chicago, and I put them all under the fictionalized Abraham Golden. Because, again, as I said earlier, if you have too many people working in one direction in these books, they tend to fall apart because people don't know who to follow. They say, oh, I've really invested in this character. Hey, where did he go? He's not doing something cool. where she's not doing something cool. So I fictionalized his role in it, but all of the investigations that happened, all of that happened, including the finale with the two Chicago police officers. I'm not going to give it away because I don't want to spoil it. But all of the investigations actually happened. There was a plot to assassinate the president in November 2nd, 1963 in Chicago. The plot of the layout of the motorcade, all of that is true. All of that was actually going to happen. And the assassin that they had picked for it, Thomas Valley, did work in a warehouse that was right next to where the president's car was going to slow down. All of that is fact.
Yeah, I actually think it's funny you mentioned Thomas Valley, because I believe I just recently listened to James Ellroy basically did like an audio drama adaption of American Tabloid.
And I heard about that.
And I believe that Thomas Valley actually makes like a very brief appearance. I mean, that book is long. But like I've definitely it also came out the year I was born. So
oh God, Jesus! I read it when it first came out. God, I feel ancient.
Yeah. Well, Ellroy is one of my biggest influences as far as writing. I had a high school English teacher who also taught film, and we watched L.A.
Confidential
that year, and he, you know, he knew I was into politics and history, so he actually gave me a copy of American Tabloid, and you know, the first time I read it, it was mind blowing, and that got me kind of into the whole Kennedy assassination conspiracy. Like, mm-hmm. Even though Ellroy has said himself that he doesn't really believe in it, that's the funny thing.
Right. I mean, and like I said, when you get into the tertiary characters, not the main movers and shakers, or even the Clay Shaws or Clay Beltran, whatever his name was, of the whole conspiracy, that's when you start losing the thread of it. But when you look at the secondary characters, like the real life Abraham Bolden, and they tell you what they uncovered at the time, that's pretty interesting stuff. And it's kind of hard to just shrug all of that off as happenstance and coincidence.
Were you able to like actually talk to any of these guys, or were you just looking at like historical transcripts and records and what?
I was looking through an awful lot of the records and an awful lot of the transcripts, found it from different sources, learned about that there were, in fact, four Cubans who were in Chicago in a hotel room at that time. The Secret Service only caught two of them. The other two escaped with the rifles. Nobody knows what happened to them. Nobody really tried to find out either, because it was over. And it's off their plate, because it's on to the next thing. There aren't, because it goes back to also what we were talking about earlier, is the myth of the hyper-prepared government. The government has a lot more resources than your county or city in most cases, but it's not an infinite resource. They do have other things that they're doing all at once. And there are only so many Secret Service agents out there, especially outside of D.C., same thing with the FBI, same thing even with the U.S. Army. There's only so many soldiers they have in one area that can do something. So when Kennedy was coming to town in November of 1962, it wasn't just this army of Secret Service agents that descended on Chicago a month before. It was the 8-person department of the Chicago field office of the Secret Service that had to do a lot of the legwork. Yeah. And they had to rely on Chicago PD detectives in their intelligence division to do the same. So, the problem people have of grasping that is that there weren't a ton of people they just throw at this stuff, because the president goes a lot of places each week. So one plot is over, they move on to the next one.
Yeah. I mean,
especially back then.
Yeah. I mean, when I was talking to Steve Stratton, you know, as you know, he was in the Secret Service. And I asked him, you know, like what his routine was and, you know, some of the protocols. And, you know, he told me, and it was, you know, pretty mind blowing what, you know, he and his team had to do, you know, just for logistics and to pre-sweep for, you know, all of that. And, you know, that was like, that was in the late 70s and 80s when he was doing that. So, you know, quite a few years removed from Kennedy's day, but even so, I mean, yeah, the logistics of the Secret Service, I mean, it's a bureaucracy like anything else.
Exactly right, with finite resources, and everything also changed after the Kennedy assassination too. If we look at what happened in 1963 through a 2024 lens, it's going to look really obscured and really off. Now, there were mistakes made that day, but I mean, the methods of following up on things like the players in the Chicago plot, you can understand why they may not have focused on that, because they went on to the next city where the president was supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing too, is like with the Chicago plot, what was interesting was you would have thought that after that, I guess, failed or went away, that the president would have just stayed in the White House, you know, for a longer period of time than he did. Because I mean, Dallas didn't, I looked up the timeline, and like Dallas happened pretty close after when Chicago happened. And I don't want to give specific spoilers away, but you do kind of foreshadow, at least the way I read it, you do foreshadow Dallas a little bit. I was kind of expecting you to maybe do like an alternate history thing, maybe where, you know, Dallas gets averted, but you didn't do that at all.
Yeah, no, I didn't. No, because as I said earlier, this novella was born out of the Dallas 63 books that I plan on writing. So it was taken from that universe where what happened in Dallas happened the way history remembers it. But that's the ironic part of all of this. If you just look at the assassination itself and you just look at the conspiracy in a box, it becomes a little bit pixelated, because you have to look at the whole world at the time of when the assassination happened. Kennedy was looking at re-election in 1964. He wasn't as strong as his people wanted him to be in terms of the polls. Lyndon Johnson was in trouble. He was in the middle of the Bobby Baker scandal. It had just broken on Life magazine a couple of weeks before Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in 1963. They didn't know if he was even going to be on the ticket with Kennedy. So there was an awful lot going on. So he went south to Texas because he needed to shore up his support. Kennedy was also wounded by things like the Bay of Pigs invasion, which had been an Eisenhower plot, and he didn't really support when he came into office as the planners thought he would. The Cuban Missile Crisis was another thing that weakened his standing, and a lot of people were anxious about that. And I think some of them who had the means to do something about their anxiety, unfortunately, hatched the plot that we now know of as being successful in Dallas. But the first one was definitely Chicago. And then there was another plot to get him in Miami, which they completely called off his trip to Miami in the middle of November of 63, because it was a similar plot to what was uncovered in Chicago. And the only reason why we know about the Chicago plot is because the real life Abraham Bolden went to the Warren Commission after all of this happened, said, I was monitoring the radio traffic when the president was planning on coming to Chicago for the Army Air Force game that Saturday, and here's what I've uncovered. The Warren Commission wouldn't let him submit that evidence because it would have hinted at, it would have actually proven there had been a conspiracy, something that was almost a mirror image of what happened in Dallas. So they threw out his testimony, wouldn't let him testify. Then they set him up for a bribery charge, and he spent 6 years in federal prison for his trouble. And it was only in 2022 that President Biden pardoned him of that charge and absolved his record.
Yeah, I don't necessarily like Biden, but let the record show that this is the one time on the show where I will commend Biden for doing something, good. Because I mean, I do think that, you know, based on everything I've read on Golden, Bolton, he was a notable figure, and it seemed like he did care about the Kennedys, even Bobby to a certain extent. I don't know how close he got with Bobby, but I mean, based on everything I've read, the Kennedys seem to really appreciate him and what he did for Jack. So
sure. Yeah, and unfortunately, they weren't able to support him when he needed them after his bribery conviction. But I'm glad that in hindsight, history got it right, and the government finally did right by this brave man.
What about one thing I'm curious about with Chicago? What about the Chicago mob and the mafia element? Do you think there was anything there with organized crime in the Kennedy assassination? Have you thought to explore that avenue at all?
I did, yes. And I don't know if it was anything that was direct or overt as it was in other parts of the assassination plot. For example, in this book, I mentioned that there were Cuban guerrilla training camps throughout the United States, both on the East Coast, down in Florida, in Louisiana, and then in other countries like Mexico and Guatemala. That actually was true. And Valley did work at one of them that was based in Long Island. So a lot of those camps were funded in this country by mafia-affiliated people. And I think in the Chicago plot, they probably directed the two police officers who I mentioned in the book, probably they made sure they pulled strings to make sure these two were part of it, because in real life, they did pull over Valley for a traffic violation, and then found all of the ammunition in his car and a lot of the stuff that happens in the novella. But I do think that they might've been involved in that way, but I didn't see anything even from back then. And even from articles that I had seen written in 1974 during my research, didn't see any mention of the boys being involved directly in the plot.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what I've often read, there's a theory out there that the mafia was involved in the assassination because they were upset that the Bay of Pigs was a flop because they were expecting Castro to be overthrown so that they could get all their casinos and operations in Havana back. Mm-hmm. And then when that fell, when that didn't happen, they got mad at Jack, and the theory is that they whacked him for that and then set up Oswald as a patsy. I don't know if the mob is even that organized, but that's another theory I've heard out there. So
yeah, I mean, they definitely had a role in funding the camps and supplying arms for the camps, but I have a feeling, and I've talked to a lot of people who are in the military, and I haven't been, but they do, and you don't get that kind of criminal mentality. It doesn't really transfer well when you're trying to prepare people to go into battle, which is exactly what the Bay of Pigs is, and also the second invasion that JFK and Bobby were planning sub rosa with from the White House after they cleaned out the CIA. That just doesn't translate well to soldiering. Now, former soldiers usually do pretty well when they go into the mob, but in terms of doing it the other way and having run the camps, I've heard that too. And I'm like, no, that wasn't it. I think they they funded it. And you also have Carlos Marcelo, who was had a personal vendetta against RFK for having FBI agents grab him one night in his slippers and pajamas,
right,
and dump him off in the jungles of Guatemala. And since he had all of those training camps in Louisiana and was helping to fund arms for them to train with throughout the country, I think he probably had a really good motive, if you will, to get a little bit of revenge. And I think that's exactly how it happened.
So then I guess here's the $1 million question, and thank God I'm not posting this to YouTube, because otherwise it would probably get pulled. But what do you think Terrence McAuley was the real story with the JFK assassination? Was Oswald a lone actor, or did he have help, or like who, I guess, in your minds killed Kennedy? Or are we going to have to read the Dallas trilogy to find out your theory on that?
Well, you don't have to necessarily read the trilogy, although I will touch heavily upon that. I said this a couple of times already, if you look at the tertiary characters, the secondary people that you don't see in every single documentary, that are not going to be bold-faced names when you're looking up an article, there's a lot of people who were in Oswald's orbit that just quite simply didn't need to be there, and they are steeped in the intelligence community. Take the Paynes, for example, Michael and Ruth Payne, who Oswald's wife was staying with. They were affiliated with the white Russian community in Dallas. Who knew Russians went to Dallas? But apparently there were quite a few of them who were exiles from communist Russia. They both were heavily involved in intelligence and intelligence gathering throughout their careers, throughout their lives, even up until the 80s. You have people like that who, when you look at them closely, you're saying, why would a nobody or a guy like Oswald, who's supposed to be nobody, be hanging around with all these connected people like George de Morenshield and all of the people who were in the background of Oswald's life that shouldn't have even needed to pass him in the street, much less take him into their home and work with him and help his family? There's just too many of them, especially in a sprawling city like Dallas, for that to be a coincidence. It's not like they bumped into him in a bar. These people actually shared part of their lives with him. And there's a lot of other, you know, and then there's also, too, when you look at the assassination day itself, there's also the murder of J.D. Tippit, which is a fascinating topic in and of itself. There were some researchers who spend their whole careers just delving into that. So there's always something, it's those secondary characters that make it more plausible for me to just think that Oswald was a useful idiot. I don't think he was innocent. He definitely was part of it. There's a lot of evidence that he was part of the camps in Louisiana, training people for a second invasion of Cuba. They thought maybe he might have been involved in the, no, I don't think he was involved in the first wave, but he was definitely involved in the second wave that they were planning. And I tend to think that they set him up to take the fall. I don't know if he pulled the trigger that day, because I don't know why somebody who's living in Dallas, Texas would write away to Chicago for a Mannlicher Carcano and then leave a paper trail when he could have gone across the street and bought a rifle. I don't understand that.
Yeah. That does seem a little fishy.
It does, yeah.
To me. My theory, I'm not necessarily saying that, like, Johnson was the one who, like, hatched the plot to assassinate Kennedy, but I have always found interesting. I've actually asked my grandmother about this because she was, she was alive when the assassination happened. But as you mentioned, Johnson was kind of on the outs with with JFK, and although he was the vice president, it didn't really seem like he and Jack got along all that well. So I'm not saying that he was behind the assassination, but it kind of was convenient for his political career that he was able to ascend to the presidency.
I've heard a lot of theories about that too. And I think that, you know, if you look at Johnson's career, he was incredibly cunning and you didn't see an awful lot of courage. You saw that he always had an angle. He always had a wedge that was off screen, if you will, that he was able to use to get his will imposed. Yeah. But I don't know if anybody who would plan something like this would trust him with that kind of information, because I have no doubt that he would have ratted them out to make himself look like a hero and save his own backside at the first opportunity. Yeah. So is he capable of it? Were people around him who benefited by him being in power capable of it? Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think they can escape consideration for collaboration. But Johnson himself, I there are a lot of people I respect who in this theory field who say he was involved. I wouldn't put it past him, but I don't think people who could pull this off would trust him with that information.
He might have involved tangentially, but he wasn't the mastermind.
Right. I don't see that. And I know a lot of people have said, well, he put Connolly in the car to take suspicion off himself later. He seemed to be very close with Connolly. They had a strained relationship later, but I don't see him doing that. And I honestly don't see him putting his friend's wife in jeopardy by doing that. I think if he caught any hint of this, and there's some people who say he did, I just don't see him being part of it game day. I just don't. So,
yeah.
Just don't see it. But I mean, if you look at different things, like Connolly always thought there was more than one shooter. He went to his grave thinking that. And if you look at a lot of the computer simulations that they show you, you have to be careful with that too, because a lot of the theories will line up the trajectory of the bullets, and they'll say, well, look, the bullet would have to be the magic bullet, you know, flipping around. What a lot of those people don't count for is that Connolly was on a jump seat, which was not flush in front of Kennedy. It was inset a bit and lower. So it did the shot as they have it in a lot of the straight line that you see going through Kennedy and then straight down into Connolly. Those ballistics do match up. There's only one problem. That's not where the bullet entered Kennedy's back. It didn't enter a straight line and go there. It was, this is a matter of record, it was further over to the right and lower.
Yeah.
So it didn't go right. There was no bullet that went through his back, went out through him, and then hit Connolly in front of him. That just didn't happen. And President Gerald Ford, who was on the committee at the time, said, yeah, but we just moved it because it just seemed cleaner that way.
Why?
Those kinds of things are weird.
Why? Now, my other question is, as far as I can tell, Kennedy wasn't wearing a vest either that day, which...
He wasn't, but he was wearing a back brace, and that's why he slump all the way forward. He was wearing a back brace because he had a bad back, and that's well documented. But no, he was not wearing a Kevlar vest or a bulletproof vest.
Well, maybe, which kind of seems, which after reading Chicago 63, I do have to wonder, and I'm not really expecting you to answer this, but this book has kind of given me pause to think, okay, well, if there was an assassination attempt in Chicago or a plot, why wasn't Kennedy wearing a vest in Dallas? And
right. Well, based on the wounds that he got, if you look at the canonical wounds, the throat and the headshot, that a vest wouldn't have helped him.
Right.
But I think that you have to look at some other things. He was also a glamour puss. He was a good looking guy and knew it. He was very photogenic. It was incredibly warm for November in Dallas that day. He had his brace on already. Even if they had thought to put a bulletproof vest on him, he probably would have been pumping sweat and he would have looked a lot heavier than he was. So I could totally see him refusing to put one on. And given the environment at the time, I could see the Secret Service allowing that to happen. I don't think they've done it since, though.
Right. No, because, I mean, we've also had, there was Reagan's assassination in the early 80s, which is also interesting.
Right.
As well.
Right. Yeah. But you saw a lot of people on the ground there, too. I mean, that was who nailed Hinckley. And also there's that incredible shot of the Secret Service pulling the Uzi out of the suitcase and running to protect Reagan. They completely changed everything after 63, a lot of their tactics on the ground. So, unfortunately, they learned a bitter lesson that day in Dallas.
What about Bobby's assassination? Are you going to do anything regarding his death or assassination? Are you primarily focused on Jack's?
Yeah, the Dallas 63 trilogy I'd like to write is definitely going to be centered just on the events that happened in the months leading up to what happened in Dallas. Then the second book in my mind would be about Oswald being in custody and what happens to him there. And then the third book will be about the pursuit of some of the people who were involved in the assassination who fled all the way up to the Canadian border. And that's actually a fact. There were some really interesting people that got away in the hours after it happened that really deserve quite a bit of scrutiny. Yeah. And that's what I plan on doing in my book.
So do you have outlines for like all three books, or are you working on each book individually, or what is your process generally for writing these types of novels?
I approach these as I approach all of my work. I don't do a lot of outlining. I do, however, when I'm getting familiar with an era in American history, take a lot of notes. So I won't be thinking of what's my protagonist going to be doing in this situation. I'm looking for inspiration from the source material, whatever that is. Sometimes it's newspapers, sometimes it's documentaries, whatever it is that's going to help get the creative juices flowing. So I've taken an awful lot of notes based on the full range of the events that happened over 3 days in Dallas. And that's what I'm working from right now. So the first book is going to be about the seeds of the conspiracy all the way through to it actually happening that day. And then the other two books are going to be about the aftermath. So I don't think I'm really going to be able to stick with the character long enough to have him delve into the RFK assassination that happened in 68. But a good friend of mine, Guy Cote, wrote a fantastic book, The Girl in the Polka Dot Dress. And I definitely think you should have him on because he did an awful lot of investigation into the RFK assassination. And he would be a great guest for you.
Yeah, I haven't listened to your podcast with him yet, but I did see it pop up on my Spotify. So I'm definitely going to listen to that probably after we finish recording this. But even now people are, there's been a ton of books on the Kennedy assassination. I think what you're doing of taking more to a grounded approach is more unique and having, your protagonist kind of be the street level protagonist instead of up in the wings trying to navigate like the deep state or the shadow government or whatnot.
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, I wanted to tell this story from the street level, not from the suite level. And that's completely, you hit it right on the head. Because I think it's more interesting that way. And I think that it becomes a lot more understandable and relatable once you have it presented, the story like this, presented in a way that it doesn't seem too foreign to you. Like the halls of power in D.C., I also think that a writer can get away with an awful lot if you keep it up in the ethereal. If it's amongst the angels, the mere mortals don't question it. And I think that at its heart, This was a street killing on the streets of Dallas in front of a whole group of people, and no one realized that it was going to be filmed, but it wound up being that way. And that was a huge problem for them after it happened. So, and they sat on that, the Zapruder film, for example, for a long, long time, and God knows what other kinds of film they're sitting on too. So it's, I think once you get lost in the weeds, and you put it perfectly, once you make it too much of a battle amongst gods, if you will, people lose interest. So I my opinion is that if you make it more of a crime-based story, people are going to be invested in it.
Yeah, I certainly think that's, you know, that's definitely the case. Now, from the flip side, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, authors, you know, riding from the wings and doing conspiracy things, because admittedly, that's what I've done with my books, somewhat. Like I said, I don't believe in, you know, conspiracy theories myself, but it is interesting to kind of be like, okay, well, if this far-fetched thing did in fact happen, then how would it, you know, how would that go? So that's been interesting to play with.
Sure.
As far as novellas go, what was that experience like for you? You know, coming down from like writing a big novel and now writing a novella, did you enjoy it or did you, you know, what did you enjoy? What did you dislike about it? And would you do it again?
Well, I've done it before. I've written four other novellas. Two of them were science fiction based, and that was a lot of fun. They didn't get a lot of attention, but that's fine. It was for a small publisher. And then I did one that was for the old Fight Card series that was put on by Paul Bishop and Mel Odom several years ago. And I tied that into my 1930s stuff. The Fight Card series were boxing centric stories about the people in and around the sweet science of boxing. So I loved doing that. I wrote another novella called The Devil Dogs of Belleau Wood. That was about the World War One battle where the modern reputation of the Marines is the baddest ass fighting force in the world was born during that battle. And all proceeds of that go directly to the Semper Fi Fund. So I wrote that pretty much from my 1930 character's perspective. Charlie Daugherty, in the course of the books, he goes on to become a New York City police detective corrupted by Tammany Hall. So, but in this book, he's a younger man fighting in Belleau Wood with his fellow Marines. And so I loved the challenge of taking a novel idea for that should be 90,000 words or more, and then shrinking it down into something that's more of a easier bit of fiction to digest. I also have written a lot of short stories. I've been lucky to be nominated for some awards for that. I've gotten some acclaim doing that. Love that form as well. Every form, whether it's a book, short story, or novella, presents its own different challenges. And sure, I embrace them because it helps keep me fresh. Because if you just sit down and you keep writing the same stuff over and over again, the same way, in the same time period, no matter how much you love it, you're eventually going to get bored. And if I'm bored, the reader's going to get bored. And I don't want that. There's always going to be competitions to pull you away from what I've written and what you've bought. You know, you've got check my Facebook or go on Snapchat or tweet or watch a football game, something. And as long as I can keep you engaged, I've got you and I want to tell you that story. I can't do that if I have... ultimately, familiarity breeds contempt. And if I have contempt for the story, so will the reader. So changing it up a little bit every once in a while keeps me fresh.
That's, I mean, I think that's pretty sage advice there, you know, for aspiring writers. And I mean, I think it's also good that, you know, you seem to enjoy writing in all these different, you know, genres too. You're not a one-trick pony, you know, which I find very refreshing.
And there's something each genre can teach a writer too. If you think that you've got a great idea, but there's nobody looking, let's say you keep an eye out for submissions requirements, and somebody says, you know what, we're only looking for short stories right now. And you say, well, I've got an idea for a full novel. Think about that. See if you can't make a short story out of it. Is there a piece of it that you could pluck out like I did? Chicago 63 came out of Dallas 63. Well, see if you can't make an independent project out of it. And if you can, maybe you've got something you can submit. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, I have short stories that I wrote back when I was a teenager that I'll never publish in their original form, but I have taken them and I've put them into some of the works that that I've written and I'm currently writing right now too. So, you know, mm-hmm. that's the other thing is using different mediums as inspiration too.
Right. And nothing you write should ever be considered a waste of time or that you can throw it away. It doesn't have an expiration date, and there is no law that says you can't use something that didn't sell once again, because I wrote my very first book that I spent a lot of my early 20s writing was a book called Tenets of Power. You're not going to find it anywhere. It never got published. It was about the high drama of the mergers and acquisitions industry. You know, these captains of industry going in, buying, selling companies, fighting for it, stuff like that. The book didn't get, I submitted it to people. It didn't get published, but the book has lived on in about four or five different other books that have since come to market. So none of the stuff that I did, I changed the names of the characters. I changed the setting, lots of different tweaks, but the core of that story has lived on in four or five different books. So my one bit of advice is to any writer at any stage, don't be afraid of the format and don't be afraid to recycle some of your stuff and give it new life. Because just because an agent or an editor didn't like it when you submitted it, doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It just wasn't right for them at the time.
What do you think of self-publishing? I've had a lot of self-published authors and traditionally published authors, but usually I tend to like to ask, guests what they think of both models. When I wrote my first short story back in 2014,
mm-hmm.
just from my observation back then, people kind of scoffed at the idea of, oh, you're a self-published author. I'm not even going to bother looking at that. Now there seems to be a bit more of an acceptance, which is great. I do think there is still a place for traditional publishing as well. But, as someone who has been in traditional publishing, I'm kind of curious what you might think of self-publishing and where the publishing industry is heading.
Well, you're starting to see it shrink as it's been a lot of these houses have been acquired by larger entities and entities with interests in other industries. You're starting to see some of it shrink. And that means that even the big publishers are limited by what they can publish, by what they can afford to bring on, because every book is an investment. And when you look at the book publishing industry as a business, their decisions and their actions become a lot clearer. As a writer, it's our art, it's our baby. We all know that. And it's deeply personal to us, but to someone else, it is a product that has to be packaged and sold, hopefully for a profit. Because if there isn't a profit, then there's no other books that they can publish.
Yeah.
So, that explains a lot of the reasons why the big publishers do what they do and why they don't do a little bit more. Anthologies, for example, you don't see too many of the big publishers publishing anthologies. That falls to a lot of the smaller independent publishers. That's because there's not a lot of yield for anthologies in a lot of markets. Just like James Patterson tried a couple of years ago to publicize the novellas, where he co-wrote with a lot of really great authors. Nothing wrong with the material. It's just that there's the margins that the bigger houses can make on something like that isn't worth their time, because they have to spend as much time marketing that as they do a full-length novel. So the idea of taking an idea to an independent publisher like Shotgun Honey or Level Best Books or Ocean View Press or several others that I'm not remembering right now is more accepted now than it used to be. You don't have to be published by Simon & Schuster or Random House. These publishing houses are publishing some really great books in a lot of different genres.
Yeah.
You look at self-publishing, let's say you don't get that and they just don't understand your story, but you have a lot of faith in it. Self-publishing has definitely gotten a lot more respect, and it should have been respected all along. The problem with that is people who engage in that endeavor need to know their limits, because you will go broke really fast if you think you can throw money at this and make it a winner. It doesn't work that way.
No.
You have to spend, but here's what you do have to spend your money on. You have to spend your money on a good editor who's going to tell you the truth. All of our family probably support us. We show it to our wives, our mothers, whomever. They love it. We're the best thing since sliced bread. I don't understand why you're not already optioned for a movie. That's right. Great. And sometimes that's an honest critique. But you need to spend the money to get someone to professionally edit it and proofread it for you so that they will tell you exactly what is right with it, what's wrong with it, and then they can make it. You can hopefully be open enough to making it better. Then when you're actually ready to bring that book to market, whether you show it to beta readers who are going to give you honest feedback and quick feedback, reasonably quick. You don't want to be sitting around years waiting for your novella to come back with edits from them.
Yeah.
You have to invest in someone who's going to properly format it and make sure that it's ready for e-publication or print publication. And those are two different things. Then you have to invest in someone who's going to do a good cover for it as well. You don't want to have a bit of clip art in Times New Roman font. You need to have someone who's not only going to design the cover, but also, if you're going to have print, the spine and the back cover too. So people have to understand that there is money that needs to be invested in this kind of an endeavor. And then you have to come up with a marketing plan. How are you going to push this out there? The worst thing, in my opinion, that people can do is spend their money on tchotchkes. You know, like you see people who come up with stickers or, these kitschy things that they include with the books when they send them out. That's really great if you've got, this is your third or fourth book and you've got money that you really want to invest in that along that way. For me, anything else beside the book, if you've got money left over, make sure you put it into social media ads or ads on Amazon or Twitter or someplace where you're going to have something, some measurable metric for the dollars invested, because there are no shortage of people that are going to line up out there when they find out you're self-publishing a book to try to get some of that money off you. Like I said, some of it works. Yeah. I mean, there's a place for the bookmarks and the stickers and stuff like that. But if you're starting out and you don't really have a budget for that stuff, stick to the basics. And then through your beta readers, see if they can help you once the book finally goes on sale, leaving reviews, word of mouth, all of that helps. You might not make the New York Times bestseller list, but you're definitely going to have a product that you're proud of and that represents you for future work.
Yeah, well, and I mean, just kind of from my experience, I mean, especially for some of the younger listeners out there, like if you're in college right now, consider doing what I did and take some marketing classes, take some graphic design classes even, because like you mentioned, having someone design a cover, I'm not trying to say I'm terrific or I'm wonderful, but like taking graphic design course and learning it like typography really helped me, learning page layout really helped me learn, okay, how do I properly format? And at the time I didn't even realize that that's what I would use all of this class for. I was just taking these as electives, but I would also say the more you can kind of self-teach and do yourself within limits, do that too if you're going to self-publish.
Yeah, definitely. If you've got the formatting skills and the ability to do your own covers and spine and back cover, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I really don't think anybody can really do themselves, and that's the proofreading and the copy editing. That's definitely going to require an investment.
Yeah. So definitely. Well, I mean, I think we've covered a lot of ground in just over an hour. And I really appreciate your time. Before we head off, I do notice that you're publishing this through Silverback Publishing. So is that your outlet or your personal imprint, or how is... You know.
Right. It's a it's an idea that James Apt over at the Best Thriller Books and his own group, BTS Designs, myself, Steve, and some other people came up with to try to give voice to the novella format, because we believe there is an appetite for shorter fiction. Because sometimes, as I said earlier, someone will be writing that thriller and they'll have a great scene, but it doesn't fit in with something. Well, doesn't mean you throw it out. As I was just talking about,
right?
You might be able to recycle it as something else. So we talked to a lot of, and I definitely talked to a lot of people while I was doing my own podcast that had ideas that weren't necessarily novels, but they shouldn't be thrown at, and they were too long for short stories. So that makes the novella a more of a appetizing project. So
yeah,
it's something that we're Silverback is something that we're all working on together. We've got my book will be first. We've got a couple of others that we're really excited about that we think people are going to enjoy. And we're learning the process of publishing, because there's an awful lot that you don't realize until you actually start doing it. So there's marketing plans there, and we all brought a different group of strengths to the enterprise, you know, either as creatives, writing the stuff, helping to get the production team together to actually bring it to market, doing the marketing once we do have a product, a lot of different ideas. So it was, it's been a really great experience to this point, and it seems like it's only going to get better now that we're getting closer to publication.
Awesome. And, you know, how has the experience of podcasting been for you? I don't know how long you've been doing it, but...
I've been doing it for about 3 years.
Wow.
And it's been fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely fantastic. I was fortunate enough to link up with my very good friend, Pam Stack, who's been a supporter of mine since the book you're reading right now, Sympathy for the Devil, came out years ago. And she's been a dear friend and very encouraging throughout my career. And she said, you know, you've got a lot of experience. Why have you ever thought about doing a podcast? And that's where the idea of Spies, Lies, and Private Eyes was born. And I record them every Tuesday and Thursday at 11 o'clock Eastern time. I record them on Zoom. I don't have a big studio or a lot of fancy sound equipment, but it's given me the opportunity to speak to writers at every stage of their career, whether they're best-selling authors, household names like Jack Carr, who I was really inspired by, all the way down to people who are just, this is their first book and they're just starting out. Or people who've had interesting lives who have decided to give novel writing a shot. It's been great being able to talk to all of those different types of people and bring a bunch of different experiences and approaches to writing to the listeners. So it's been a great ride.
It's been, I can, as a listener, I've been listening probably since December. It's been great just to tune in and, you know, hear perspectives and, you know, then check out a few authors who I hadn't even heard of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on behalf of, you know, of a few listeners, thank you. And your service there is much appreciated. So,
well, thank you. It's my honor. It's great being able to bring new voices to people. And there's a lot of really great writers out there in the thriller and crime genres. So I encourage everybody, keep your eyes open, because there's a lot of really great stuff coming out in the next year or so.
Indeed. Anything that you want to promo before we, head out? I will leave links, to, you know, Chicago 63 and your website and everything else, but anything you want to mention specifically?
It's just that all of my backlist is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, in print, in digital. Some of them are even audiobooks, especially my Westerns.
Yeah.
A lot of those are available in audiobooks as well. And I always say to people, you know what, even if you're not going to read one of my Westerns, don't be afraid to give it a shot, because the genre itself is not just a bunch of people in cowboy hats and horses shooting everyone at high noon. There's some really great storytelling being told there by artists today and also from the past. So I would say give it a shot. And if you land on something you like, you'll have a whole different type of book that you might enjoy. And always, please, no matter what happens, no matter what genre you read, even if it's nonfiction, please leave a review either on Amazon, Goodreads, or someplace else, because every one of those reviews, even if you didn't like it, be honest, leave an honest review, but every one of those reviews helps an author get a little bit higher in the ranking, and every little bit helps, especially with a crowded marketplace like there is now.
I appreciate you saying that, because the one thing that I've gotten a lot of, I always get people who, you know, send me DMs on Facebook or, you know, Messenger. Man, I loved your first novella. When is the second one coming out? And I'm like, well, you know, I appreciate it, but can you please go on Amazon and, you know, leave a review or something like that? I don't know why. I think people tend to forget the, you know, leaving a review sometimes.
Right.
So.
And it really helps too, especially if someone gets a lot of solid reviews, even if they're self-published. And this is something that has definitely changed since you self-published, even only a few years ago, is that if it's well-reviewed and well-received, and you query somebody, an agent or a publisher, for your second book, even though the first one's self-published, it can get a lot of attention that way, because nowadays publishers really appreciate a good following when they bring an author in. So even though, yeah, maybe the book is self-published, if you leave that review, you are helping that author's career in the future. So that's why I always say, please do that.
I would say the same of podcasting too. Like I said, I've been podcasting since I was 14. You know, and that was real before people even commonly knew what a podcast was.
But
I would say even the same thing. Like, you know, if there's a, you know, not everyone is going to be a Joe Rogan or an Adam Cole or take your pick. That's the one thing I get from like a lot of my friends, or, you know, from some younger people I know. I just turned 29, but I know some 21-year-olds are like, man, I want to start a podcast, meet the next Joe Rogan, and it's like, well, I'm almost 30, I'm nowhere near Rogan's level, and I'm probably never going to be, but
right.
I found a niche. I've built a pretty good following. The other thing I've found is, whether it be writing or podcasting or whatever, persistence is key too.
Yes.
My first short story that I wrote back in 2014, it actually did absurdly well, considering that I basically wrote I was in a competition with a friend of mine from high school. We made a really stupid kind of bet that we were both going to just publish like a novel or short story, just kind of first draft, put it on Amazon, mm-hmm. and see which one of us would sell better. I won somehow. And so my first short story, I went back and read it recently, and it has some holes, but it's not terrible either.
Right.
But I would also say persistence is key for, you know, for writing or for anything.
And having a thick skin too, and being able to be self-critical. Sonny Liston always said, Sonny Liston said, everybody's got a plan till they get hit. Mike Tyson later said, everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the face. It's the same principle applies, in that once you put something on paper and then you have the guts to show it to somebody, which is why the editing is important, and they tear it apart or they just didn't like it, if you can't take that, then this is not for you. This art form is not for you.
Right.
Because you're always going to get people, there are going to be some people who love everything you do, and there are going to be some people that no matter what you do, they're just not going to like it. And then there's the people in the middle that are willing to give you a chance. So, yeah. But you have to be open to that feedback and constructive feedback, not just somebody looking to tear you down.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody who's never swung a golf club before tells you that your swing is off, well, okay, that doesn't really help me. But if a golf professional pulls you aside and says, this is how you do it, you're better off listening to them because they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, most definitely. So, well, you know, Terrence, I really appreciate your time. I'd love for you to come back, you know, when, you know, the Dallas Trilogy, when one of the books is, when do you think you'll publish the first book?
I've been fortunate enough that my agent has found a couple of houses that are interested. So right now we're talking with them to see what's going to happen and when. So the best I could say about that is stay tuned. I hope to have some good news soon.
All right. Well, you know, I'd love to have you back on, you know, as we draw closer to that date. I really appreciate you coming on. And folks, I really appreciate you guys for listening. You know, Terrence is a great guy. And as I said, he has a lot of wisdom and experience in the writing field. And I really thank you for your time, sir. So.
No problem at all. Anybody has any questions, you can find me at my website. The links will be here. Just send me an email and I'll do my best to help you out.
Alrighty, folks. Well, thank you for listening and I'll see you on the live show on Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to The Whitfield Report on the NGC Network. Please visit Sam's website at www.thesamwhitfield.com and support Sam on Patreon at patreon.com/Whitfield Report. Until next time, God bless. God save this great nation, and God, freedom, legacy, in that order.